I'd like to build on, I think, both what Mike and Hal said. In my letter, I strongly recommended that you delete paragraph 12B, critical accounting estimates. And there were really a couple of reasons. Number one, I think that, again, this is part of the overall notion of there's just too much in the requirements. But Hal made an interesting point, and that is that to the extent that some of this information is useful, it's useful on a much broader scale. It might be useful to investors, for example. In thinking about this, these are new requirements for the most part. Description of the process used by management to develop the critical accounting estimates, how various selections within the range would affect the basically the PCAOB is setting accounting and or disclosure requirements here, except they're not disclosing them to anybody except the audit committee. And it seems to me that the appropriate way to go about this is that the SEC ought to be thinking about these kinds of things for MD&A, for example, or the FASB ought to be thinking about them for purposes of footnote disclosures. Frankly, I think that it goes well beyond anything the FASB should be interested in right now, but possibly the SEC might be interested in some of these things. But it just doesn't strike me as the kinds of things that the PCAOB should be asking auditors to be focusing on. Now, I recognize Marty has made this point a couple times already, that it's stated in the context of we really think that management should be thinking of these things, and it's only if management doesn't bring them to the attention of the audit committee, then the auditor should. Frankly, that's stated as the last part of this paragraph. I would make the change and put that as the first part of the paragraph rather than the last. I think that would be an important emphasis change. But mainly, I think that these are matters that are getting well beyond what the responsibility of the auditor should be, and are expanding, frankly, requirements even beyond what management needs to do with respect to most of these things. These are kind of interesting things in some respects. I don't really think that it's very practical. I'd be interested in Arnie and some other people's comments on this, but to the extent for example, what various selections within the range of estimates would be, that could be an endless range of possibilities. I will tell you, for example, for Fannie Mae's loss reserves of $60 billion right now on a $3 trillion book of business, there are lots of possible outcomes of that. And I don't know how many different possibilities that either Deloitte or internal financial management could come up with there, depending on different assumptions that would be made. And that's obviously an extreme example, but even in the simplest situation, I suspect there would be many different possible outcomes. And I think that each of these is fairly subjective, and they're kind of nice to know types of things, but just go beyond, I think, what really is necessary and add to the burden.
Jenny, I'd just like to point out many of the and as Steve had mentioned, when we were working on the proposed standard, we look to the existing standard, the requirements in there now, plus recognizing Sarbanes-Oxley and SEC rules. There were additional communication requirements that aren't reflected in the board's current standard today, but which nonetheless impose a responsibility on auditors to communicate to the audit committees. So the requirements, I think one we had expanded on, but regarding critical accounting policies and critical accounting estimates, those were derived from the SEC's rules. So we incorporated those into the standard to make it easier for auditors to have that direction in one place, make sure they weren't missing any of the communications, but they're largely derived from from requirements that exist today, but from the SEC.
Suggesting that 12B is all required by existing standards? I tried to check back that, and I was not able to do that. It's a little confusing, but I tried very hard to go back and forth between existing standards and existing SEC rules, and 12B kind of eluded me, but I thought that much of it was new.
Yeah, Denny, just 12B, a good part on accounting estimates is relatively new. It would be B, 2, 3, and 4. Those are relatively new. I think 1, 2, and 3 are fairly closely tied to what the auditor is required to do now to audit fair value estimates. It's 13B and 13E that are current requirements in the SEC rules, so critical accounting policies and practices and alternative treatments permissible under GAAP.
I was speaking more of the communication requirements, not what the auditor's requirements were.
One of the I appreciate the input again, Denny. It's very valuable. We are observing some of the ways in which FASB is going and communicating to investors is emphasizing the importance of disclosures to investors around ranges. To your point, very difficult to get to that one number of $60 billion, I think you said, on the multi-trillion dollar portfolio. And there's probably a number of reasonable estimates other than that number. And similarly, with respect to fair value in FASB's most recent proposals, is a requirement proposed for disclosures to investors of other reasonable values that could have been selected in addition to the one that was selected. And I guess the point in there is in communicating to either the audit committee or shareholders that none of these numbers is the precise number. And there are very wide ranges today with these areas of measurement uncertainty. And the better informed that either audit committees are or investors to understand how wide those ranges might be and why management selected the number they did seems to be an important factor in where FASB is headed with some of their disclosures and informing our thinking to some degree here as well. But thank you for those comments.
Okay, we have several 10 cards up, so I'd like to get everyone's thoughts. Jim Cox?
I was going to address Hal's concern. When I read this, and it could be just the wisdom of the parable about the blind man and the elephant, because we want to make sure that language overcomes the parable. And that is that when I read and have read significant or critical, I thought it was vis-a-vis a fair presentation of the financial statements, not the end user or not to management nor to the audit committee, but for the matter for which the auditors are rendering an opinion, which is that the financial statements fairly present the financial position and performance. And then on Denny's point, I think it is true, Denny, that this does not is not a mirror image of the SEC rules about this question, which is implementing not just Sarbanes-Oxley requirements, but it goes back to earlier to exchange listing requirements that were there before SOX mirrored the same requirement. But I think what it's really seeking, and again, this may just be the blind man and the elephant, and maybe we'll see if we want to clarify that with language, is to make sure that this discussion, which is mandated between the auditor and the audit committee, is as intelligent as it possibly can be under the circumstances. And I think that that's why you want to have some emphasis here as to the accounts. Now the devil's in the details and about what we mean by significant and critical, and there's lots of methodologies that could be employed there. But the important thing is that the auditors engage the audit committee in a discussion about how a handful of estimates or judgments or assumptions could very much change the presentation of the firm's performance and position. That's the point, I believe.
Thanks, Jim. Ernie Hanisch.
Thanks, Jennifer. A couple of points. So I think that, as it was pointed out, that these are suggestions, and that these are management's responsibility to a large extent, and if management doesn't do it, then I think the auditor clearly has the responsibility to jump in. But one of the points on, as far as the requirement to get to, I think it's your second question there, around consultations by the auditor outside of the engagement team on significant matters. I'm troubled by what's written on page 4, where it says proposed standard also added a new requirement for the auditor to communicate to the audit committee any consultations by the auditor outside the engagement team related to significant accounting matters. I'm really troubled by the use of those words, any consultations. I mean, again, there ought to be a degree of materiality, significance. There are many requirements today that auditors have to go to their national office for consultation on matters that, at least with regard to the companies, believe may not be as significant, but they are required to go to their national office because it's a CYA to some degree. And so I would be very cautious with the way these words are written by saying any consultations. So I would suggest that be modified. I think that I am extremely troubled by the reference with regard to the range of outcomes on accounting estimates. Whether the FASB is headed in one direction or not, I think it's a I don't think we've seen the last discussions around that as far as providing ranges of outcomes in our financial disclosures. I think that is fraught with issues, and I would hope that we wouldn't necessarily see alternative numbers appear in our financial reporting disclosures around accounting estimates, because then that just opens up a whole can of worms as far as the litigation issues around, well, why didn't the company book this number versus this number versus this number? These are generally accepted. These financial statements are fairly presented under GAAP. We all know there's a whole host of estimates that are embedded in these numbers, and we believe they're reasonably materially correct. Auditors audit those numbers, agree that they are materially correct in accordance with GAAP, and that really should be the end of it, in my view. Again, I think if the audit committee wants to understand what were the thought processes that went into a determination of judgment, whether it's Fannie Mae reserves or, in our case, it's reserves set up for litigation on product liability cases, it's certainly within the purview of the audit committee to challenge us as management to sit here and review with them the rationale behind how we came to the numbers that we came to, because there are a whole host of assumptions that, and outcomes that can take place. But I think for the auditors to have to provide judgment on that, they have provided judgment. They've certified our financial statements, and that should be sufficient in my view. Thank you.
Thanks, Arnie. Just one clarification, and you did pick up a good catch with the addition of the word any in the briefing paper, which is not in the standard itself. So that was a good catch, reading catch on your part. But it does go on to say that any consultations related to significant accounting matters. So I agree with you, it's any consultations didn't belong there, the word any, but the word significant accounting matters does belong there. But still, I think the point is, we did get a number of comments regarding what you said, and that is that there's a lot of consultations that may be required by firm policy that the audit committee doesn't need to hear about. So it's still an important point for us to rethink as we go through this. Thanks.
Thanks, Marty. Hal, I think you were trying to get my attention earlier, maybe to respond to Jim.
I just wanted to respond to Jim's comment about significant. When I think about significant, it really varies from period to period, quarter to quarter, week to week, month to month. I've been somewhat cynical about this when I talk to our investors. I tell them that the market generally can only think about one issue per quarter, and that may be even being a little generous. So significant, and I'm thinking about MPAs for banks or net interest margin, they'll pick one issue and really hone in on it. So if the management is dealing with, is this a non-performing asset or not, the degree of significance drops degree of materiality drops tremendously if the entire market has built up an expectation about something. If the market is not focused on it, you can actually argue that materiality can widen out and in less will bother the market. So you're going to map this fair presentation concept against, I think, market expectations. And then I, again, operate under the assumption that all things are estimates in a balance sheet anyway. So, you know, we may be looking at MPAs and looking for a call in the turn of a market, and we saw this earlier this year. MPAs started to stabilize, and all of a sudden, people got all excited and they ran banks up for a short while. Was that the right answer? I think that if I were an audit committee, I would be looking at that number and that estimate for that quarter a lot harder than I would have in the middle of when times are very good. So it's a moving, basically significant and critical are moving targets.
Okay, thanks. Just for a time check, as I'm sure you're all aware, we are over our estimated time or our agenda for this morning, but this is also a very important area that we receive comments on, so we want to continue this discussion until noon, and then we'll reevaluate our agenda for the afternoon after lunch. So moving on, Joanne Wagner.
Thank you, Jennifer. A couple of things. I first wanted to say that I really enjoyed Arnie's comments on the range of outcomes, and certainly am in agreement with those. I would also say that with respect to this item alone, I believe there would be a significant cost factor associated with being responsible for the developing of that data, should we need to do so. Secondly, as I was going through paragraphs 12 and 13, I was trying to picture myself in an audit committee meeting on either side, didn't matter which side I was going to go on, and I was trying to sort of see how is that meeting flowing along. And so I'm picturing a conversation starting to develop with the discussion of accounting policies and moving on to critical accounting estimates. And then it comes back again to another concept of critical accounting estimates in the next section and so forth and so on. And so I found that I could get really kind of muddled up in terms of what I'm talking about at any particular point in time. And whether or not this section of the meeting would actually be effective in terms of actually achieving a good communication. What it seems to me that could be done to really significantly improve paragraphs 12 and 13 is to integrate them so that there is a more natural flow between this concept of significant and critical as you organize it, to have just one discussion on the topic rather than having to go back and forth in terms of identification versus what the auditor thinks about them and so forth and so on. That just might make for a little bit better of a flow. And lastly, with respect to consultations outside of the engagement team, in a firm my size, we are a single office firm. Basically, I kind of am the national office. No disrespect to Mr. Ranzilla, of course. And so what we have on our publicly held engagements is we have an engagement partner, and we also have the engagement quality reviewer, and I am neither one of those. So I always consult on the financial statement side and review the filings. So we have three partners that are associated with our publicly held filings. And so just as a matter of course, since we are all in one office and we can easily find each other, I am consulted fairly frequently in terms of, let's just talk it out, have you ever seen this? I also have what I would call a consultation network, which is outside of the firm, that I also bounce things off of, which is calling someone else and say, have you experienced this before and what would you do? Which is more in what I would term educational rather than saying in this specific set of circumstances, what would you do? And so someone earlier had suggested that it be written more in terms of the principle involved. What is it? What issue is it that you really want to address here? What is it that the audit committee wants to know? And I would say what the audit committee probably really wants to know, which were the close calls, which were the tough calls, which are the ones. And certain things about consultations are just going to emanate very naturally from such a discussion like that. And so one of the things that struck me in various places throughout the standards that sometimes, you know, the proposed standard is asking about the source of the issue rather than the issue itself. And I would say if you wrote the principle to just address the issue itself, it might focus things a little bit more in the meeting. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Linda Griggs?
Thank you, Jennifer. I just wanted to point out, I think those criterion 12B are really consistent with the SEC's MD&A requirements for disclosures about critical accounting estimates. And given that I think critical accounting estimates are the most important thing for the financial statements, it doesn't offend me in one bit to have these identified in the standard as being very important items that should be addressed if either management has not addressed it or there is something that the auditor wants to supplement. I do agree with the points about the different outcomes, and unfortunately the SEC has tried over the years to get good disclosures about what would happen if the assumptions used in critical accounting estimates were changed. How would it differ? And by and large, those disclosures are pretty weak. And I don't know whether this is an exercise that management typically goes through or not. I don't know. I mean, in the first instance, it should be management making the judgment as to whether it should be going through that exercise. I agree that it shouldn't be the auditor going through that exercise, but to the extent management didn't go through that exercise as an audit committee member, you probably want to know why and whether, notwithstanding not having gone through the exercise, everybody was comfortable with the judgment made. Thanks.
Thanks, Linda. Don Nicolaisen?
I'd like to support Mike's comment, and which I think others have as well, about the consultations and what's the reason for the consultation as opposed to trying to dictate something too finite. I also say that from a slightly different perspective, and it may just be my own oddity, but I would be one of the things I always do want to know is who else did the auditor consult with, because my expectation is that there would be broad consultation in areas that are difficult or complex, and that would take place. And it's sort of reaffirming to me to know that, you know, they've bounced it off their national office. They've also talked to some of the other firms, and they have a pretty good idea of what the key elements are that ought to be considered, and that they've thought about it, and then they can give a reasoned professional judgment as to why our company is in a range of acceptability. The other thing that I would comment on is that I think we're looking for those things that are really out of the mainstream. So if there's an oddity in the accounts that were not were you'd expect it to be, that conversation would take place as well, and that it wouldn't just be so mechanical sounding. I don't think that's the intention here, but you could get there. It's not the mechanics, it's the really living discussion of what took place, what was critical and what was important and what was thought about, and how do we go through those estimates. The last point that I would make, and it may be outside the parameters of this document, but it troubles me that in financial reporting, in the public world, audited financial statements, that in things like we've lived through in subprime mortgages and other areas, there are incredibly different ranges of estimates for precisely the same characteristic securities that appear in financial statements, all labeled fair value, and all receiving a clean audit opinion. And same audit firm, I'm sure, signs off on many different values for the same security, depending upon what their client is. And I think that denigrates the value of financial reporting. I think it causes people to be skeptical about what the process is, how it works, why the auditors don't have stronger views, how it gets articulated. I certainly would want to know where our company falls in the range of what is acceptable to that particular firm. And also within the industry, but I think so does the investor. I think it's critically important that at some point where we have this range of estimates that are out there, that there be sufficient guidance to the audit firms. And I think it has to come from the PCAOB as to what do you accept and what do you not accept, and how broad can that range actually be. And I know in the early days in 08 that the ranges were just incredibly broad of what was accepted, and it's probably narrowed down now, but that's troubling to those who are trying to rely on financial information.
Thanks, Don. Gary Kabrick.
Thanks, Jennifer. Yet, in the interest of time, I'm going to limit my comments to only your fourth question about how to clarify what consultations are required to be brought to the attention of the Audit Committee, and I'll spend almost all the time on, I'll call it, management consultations as opposed to auditor consultations. And some of this I included in my comment letter, but I would repeat some of it as well, is that I would advise the board to be very careful about how you define who is an accountant that management might have a consultation with. I think it's a no-brainer if it's in the form of someone who is a potential to be a new auditor, the opinion shopping type role, and I don't think anyone here would disagree with that. But then as you start going down to, there's other accounting firms out there. There's boutique firms that only do accounting research. They have no ability, no intent to practice as an auditing CPA firm. Is that the type of accountant you have in mind? So a company might decide it's cost-effective to, in effect, outsource the really technical research. Is their view of cost and benefit and skills that are available to them. I would submit, as long as the managing committee or the board sort of knew that's generally how finance was operating or organized, I would think that would probably be sufficient. And your question 12 in the March release talked about non-accounting firms such as consulting firms. And again, I think in the ordinary sense, maybe not in every instance, but the ordinary sense, I wouldn't think those consultations would normally be advised, would not normally need to be advised to the audit committee. Give an example. Actuarial firms very well know FAS 87 and 106, and the largest actuarial firms, I would submit, know it better than the national offices do. That's their job, to understand this thing. Likewise, I think the large law firms understand FAS 5 and range of possible outcomes in remote and reasonable probable litigation settlements and so on. So I think that's all part of the management process of who you engage to help support your business. And I think there's other examples. There's valuation firms who may or may not know FAS 157 very well, but they certainly, presumably, if they're a proficient firm, understand how to value in some capacity the instrument in front of them. So, I don't think that's something the audit committee would not normally need to hear about absent some significant problem in that area. One thing I did wrestle with that's not in my comment letter is, what do you do when you've got a firm on contract to you who might have an independence issue but you consult with? Well, might be best explained by example. And we've got our independent accounting firm, but we've outsourced a large portion of our internal audit work to another Big Four firm. And we do routinely talk to them. We actually don't go to them for accounting advice, but it doesn't mean those questions don't come up from time to time in the context of an audit finding. And we have another Big Four firm who does various go-to-market activities with us at the moment. So, I would think in either of those cases, the go-to-market or the internal audit, they would have a significant independence issue today, which some of it might be able to resolve by stopping doing work tomorrow, and some of it might need a block of time before they could potentially pick up the audit. So again, I'm not suggesting what the answer should be, Marty, but I'm suggesting it should be addressed if it otherwise could do an audit but it blocked for independence reasons that may or may not be curable. And then with respect to the auditor consultations, I'll just make it very quickly. I think many of the people in the room have made the point. you really want to hear about the things the audit engagement team wrestled with and lost sleep over, and there's a lot of routine stuff that goes on, including education amongst the staff members and so on. And we, as a multinational, we view it that we hired the firm and all the firm's resources. In fact, would strongly encourage national office and other specialty consultations, but it doesn't necessarily immediately follow. The audit committee needs to be advised of every one of those, because a lot might be routine or ordinary course of business. And again, you're back to, you want to hear about the ones that the firm engagement partner lost sleep over. Thank you.
Thanks, Gary. I had just to make sure I was clear in your point, I think I am. You were talking about management consultations with other accountants, which is in paragraph 15 of the standard, I think. And, you know, just so everybody's clear, we did not specifically ask that. We weren't considering that to be included as part of this discussion. And certainly appreciate your views. But we didn't specifically tee that up in the roundtable specific question, because we got pretty consistent feedback, kind of similar to the comments that you were
saying. I'm sorry, that's the only place I saw consulting with outsiders in the document, and I didn't read it that closely. I'm sorry.
Okay, very good. All right.
Can I just add one more comment? What I've been hearing from a number of parties is it's the language that becomes a little tricky, and whether it's the word significant or something else. Many of the people around the table are saying they want to hear about that matter. That's the close call that's being discussed with national office, and audit committee members want to hear that. They're trying to wrestle whether that all significant consultations on significant accounting matters equals that or not. And so it's I think the important aspect for us to take away on that is, yes, a lot of people want to hear about those close calls. How we articulate what that is in this standard is the challenging thing. So thank you very much for those comments.
Sam Renzillo.
Well, I think that I want to make just a couple of points in this area. And that I think this was a real opportunity that maybe could be lost of revisiting some of the terms that are used in here. I mean, Hal, I think your count was 24, significant and critical. I'm going to do this at the danger of having two former chief accountants at the SEC in the room, one really close. But exactly what is the difference between a critical accounting policy and a critical accounting estimate? What is the difference between a critical accounting policy and a significant accounting policy? And I will tell you, having been involved with writing guidance for our people over the years, you know, people will get into debates for days about whether it's a significant accounting policy or a critical accounting estimate, and whether or not you fit into this bucket or that bucket with respect to a particular matter. And then, you know, most of the time I say, well, is it important? Yep. Well, then just get on with it, right? And let's go ahead. It doesn't matter if it's A or it's B. It's important. And I have struggled with this. I think critical accounting estimates, critical accounting policies have been added to the vernacular as a reaction to a situation, and I just wonder if we could, because I think we all agree, and I shouldn't say that, I think some people agree that what paragraphs 12 and 13 really go to, however you structure them, is where as an auditor did you devote the most significant amount of your time, and where at the end of the day did you, this isn't a very eloquent term, but did you gulp and say, this is a close call. There's a range. I'm not big on ranges, but there's a range with respect to a matter. I might have consulted outside the audit team. I might not have. But what was the most significant decisions that you made, and the one with the most measurement uncertainty associated with it? I think that's what we think audit committees ought to know. And I just think we've cut and paste from a number of different places, and I just think maybe we've lost an opportunity. I think that includes a discussion with the SEC about some of their terms. As it relates to, I don't think you've asked this question, so a little value add. I'll tell you one of the things that does concern me about the standard is trying to apply paragraphs 12 and 13 four times a year on each interim period. I mean, if you just pick out one critical accounting estimate, any significant change to assumptions, I don't know what critical accounting estimate doesn't have a significant change in assumption, at least quarterly, maybe actually more often than that. And I think on a quarterly basis, we could have toggled this thing way too tight in terms of compliance on a quarterly basis. Last item, consultations and reporting. I think the standard as it's written, I can implement it to make sense. The only thing I would caution you is, for those that do have concerns, we shouldn't do anything in an auditing standard that will reduce people's comfort with consulting outside of their engagement team. Because I have read some comment letters that said, you know, we think this might cause people, because they don't want to communicate when they consult outside the team, they have discomfort with that it might reduce consultations. I have never seen an issue that is benefited by reducing consultation within our firm. There's always limits to what makes sense, but at the end of the day, the more people you talk to, the more knowledgeable people you talk to about an issue, usually you end up at a better place. And I wouldn't want to see us do anything, whether I don't feel that concerned within my own firm that would happen, but I read enough comment letters that I would make sure that didn't occur in whether it's smaller or different situated type firms. Thanks.
Not responding as former chief accountant, but the thing that, as an audit committee member, that I am extremely interested in is, does the auditor understand the issues? And did they deal with them, and did they reach do they have the basis? Can they articulate the basis for their considered professional judgment as to the conclusion that they reached? And so while, in a sense, you're talking about that level of communication, the communication that I'm trying to understand is, I want to be able to evaluate, did this audit firm do the job that I'm expecting them to do? And have they covered the areas that I'm particularly interested in? And if the answer to that is no, then we're back to, you know, that it's not a communications issue. It's a matter of, you got to go back and convince me. You've got to build that trust. That relationship really has to be there. And a lot of that is hard to write in an auditing standard. And I know that the auditors may take offense at you know, an attempt at communication as being at least one person's tool to use to understand, did they get it? Are they doing the things that they really need to do? And I just throw that in because I wanted to respond to Sam's point.
Thank you. Roger Coffin.
Thank you. When you look at over the past 25 years, what are the jobs of the board of directors? Probably the first one is to select the CEO and the management team, and to make sure that the CEO and the management team have the proper ability to do their jobs. And really nothing in Dodd-Frank or Sarbanes-Oxley has supplanted that role. And so when I look at, and it was discussed a little bit, but to come at it from the perspective of a board member, this concept, if management has not adequately communicated some of these disclosures, if I'm a board member and I'm hearing that, reading this standard, I'm saying to myself, somewhere along the line, my auditing firm has made a judgment that my auditor has not done a good job of either disclosing or has not communicated in some way. And I think what that really gets the point to is that I would almost be duty-bound at that point to ask why, as an audit committee member. Does management not have the appropriate tools? Do they not have the budget? What are they missing? Why am I getting this from you when we all agree that these are good things to understand, and I need to know this to be informed? Upon what basis is your judgment made? So I'm wondering if there could be some drafting, or there could be, I don't know, maybe the way to put it is almost like the gateway question into this. Is the gateway question is, does, in the auditor's judgment, does management have the, what I'd call the suite or the tools to be able to make all of these things? And it gets a little bit, I think, to what Tom was talking about, the peer group, too, because that's another thing that I would like to know. How is this being made in relation to peer group estimates and so forth? So I guess that I think from a standpoint of oversight, you would want to know, one, why this is happening in this context, and then the broader question of, are there any structural deficiencies in this process from the auditor's perspective? Thank you.
Thanks, Roger. I wanted to go back to one thing that that Sam raised before, if I may, just to clarify a little bit for the rest of the group, and I'm sure Sam knows this. We tried to be relatively careful not to change the responsibilities of the auditor with respect to interim reporting and their responsibilities on quarterly reporting. But I guess your point is, to the extent we changed some of the requirements here in this proposed standard compared to existing AU 380, that makes the communication at interim some additional communications possibly. But the context, though, is similar to what is in existing auditing standards today. The standard with respect to interim financial information deals with communications to audit committees. And the existing standard says that, when conducting a review of interim financial information, the accountant should determine whether any of the matters described in existing AU 380 communications with audit committees relate to financial information that the audit committee needs to be aware of, such as how management formulated particularly sensitive accounting estimates, etc. So the concept is still there in the existing interim review requirements by auditors, but I guess the point being that to the extent the requirements are more extensive here, it just makes the interim burden a little bit bigger. But there is a similar requirement today.
Lynn Turner.
First, on the consultation issue, I think Don's comments, I definitely reiterate, and he probably said it better than I could, but on the comments by Sam, I think it probably would be beneficial if you included a sentence or two in here that said something to the fact that the PCAOB does encourage consultation when appropriate, and actually make a positive statement, because you certainly don't want to reduce consultation at all. I don't think you want to limit it, though, just to the national office. I can think of situations where I was chairing audit committees, and it was Bob's firm, and we went to tax specialist. It was Sam's firm, and we went to actuaries or valuation specialist. And it was a good thing. I mean, it wasn't a weakness in the audit partner. We were trying, these firms turn around and tell you that they bring a firm to the table, not just an individual audit partner. And so when you reach out to other pieces in that firm and you get that expertise, it would seem to me as an audit committee member, you want to get informed about those situations. So having them come with that information to you is extremely helpful. So again, I really echo what Don was saying in respect to that. With respect to paragraph 12 and 13, in particular 12B, I'll reiterate and note that the Council for Institutional Investors, in their comment letter, there were three things or so that they actually commented on. This was one of them. And they are extremely supportive, as am I, of the provisions in 12B. In fact, so much so that if someone told me as an audit committee member they aren't getting 12I, or 12B little I, 2 through 4 there, I would have serious questions about whether that audit committee member is actually doing their job. Investors have said, and they clamored more and more for this because they haven't been able to get the information because of the thing Linda teed up about the disclosures, that they want to know what the auditor thinks about where the numbers are coming out in the range. And in fact, the existing auditing standard on auditing estimates has a provision in it that says the auditor may very well actually have to do their own calculation of that number and compare it to what management has done and make an assessment about that. That's in the existing standard. We aren't creating new things. We aren't creating new cost. In fact, if people aren't doing that, it raises a question as to whether they're complying with GAS. And so as Don said, again, where you have a wide range and you've got a possibility of picking a number in that wide range, it's not to say that management's picked a wrong number, but investors do like to know where it is. And investors told us on the Treasury ACAP committee, we heard testimony from a number of them that it's very important to them. We had heard testimony from investors that they want to know what the investor or where the auditor came out on those estimates and what they thought. Well, if they aren't even sharing that with the audit committee, who's supposed to be overseeing the process, I think very consistent with the council letter, there's something missing here, and there's a big disconnect, a huge disconnect between what investors think the audit committees are doing in their oversight and monitoring role and what is actually occurring. And so I think what you've got there is very consistent with the SEC rules. It's very consistent with what investors are asking for. I kind of share Sam's view about critical, where you call it critical or significant or, you know, important, but that's water over the dam. The SEC's got a lot on their plate this year, and so the possibility of going through that, it's probably, and it shouldn't be a priority to them. So I think staying consistent with what they've got is probably the best thing you can do, short of just saying, talk to us about damn important items. So, which I suppose if you did it that way, then people would probably understand it.
Thanks, Lynn. Bob Dorr.
Thanks, Jennifer. I can be fairly brief here because actually I'm very much in line with Roger's earlier comments and thank the staff for acknowledging perhaps some shortcomings in the drafting around management's responsibilities for some of these communications. But perhaps to take it a step further, I think it would be very helpful. Nobody disagrees that the audit committee should be provided with any and all information that they need to discharge their oversight responsibilities. But to gloss over management responsibilities, I think, is a problem. And I would ask the staff to consider embellishing around the importance of that management communication from a couple of different aspects, one not the least of which being is certainly is a deficiency in internal control or financial reporting that shouldn't be glossed over. But equally as important, I think the real value to the audit committee would be having management's perspective and then the auditor's evaluation or the auditor's perspective on these issues, such as what does critical mean and what is significant. And where are we going with those types of things? And just to simply say that, it's the auditor's responsibility to step in if those communications aren't made. Don't disagree with that, but really impacts, in my mind anyway, the effectiveness of how the audit committee can discharge their oversight responsibilities in the absence of management communication.
Thanks, Bob. Arnie, I'll let you have the last word.
Yeah, thanks, Jennifer. Just hopefully these won't be redundant, but I think that responsibility with regard to this 12B, and I'll go to the little 4, again, to reiterate that management has this responsibility. I think it's important, however, for the audit committee to understand what decisions and what assumptions where there might have been close calls. I think either Mike Cook or somebody alluded to that. I don't recall who it was that made the statement, but I agree that the audit committees need to understand where there were close calls. One of the things that concerns me as a member of management, however, is that there are wide outcomes and wide ranges of outcomes with multiple assumptions, I would hope that if management doesn't do an adequate job of communicating changes in basic assumptions, where there's been changes to the consistency of those assumptions, that the auditors would step in and disclose that appropriately. And that wouldn't trouble me if I, as a member of management, at least failed to communicate to my audit committee where there were significant changes. One of the concerns I have is that where those changes, however, where you get into a disagreement or a judgment factor with your auditors as to where those changes could result in different numbers, then it's a matter of a debate inside of an audit committee as to which number is better. These are management's financial statements, and in a estimate for a liability, that there could be an outcome which ranges anywhere from $50 to $100 million. You've chosen a number that you think is reasonable and accurate within a framework. What I think would be difficult would be to get into the dialogue within an audit committee discussion as to the distinction between why the auditors felt one number was better than the other, if the assumptions clearly were not wrong on either party, but it was management's judgment to go one direction versus another. That's one of the concerns that I have when I read 12B, that you can find yourself potentially getting into that debate within an audit committee structure that may put the firm in an awkward position with not only the audit committee but also with the auditors.
Thanks, Arnie. Mike, it looks like you wanted to add something. Microphone.
And a suggestion having to do with this area of management responsibility and management communication versus the auditor's communication. Just something for you to think about is whether the term adequately is going to be sufficient, is going to be understood, and whether it is clear here that if the auditor has a different view than management, even if management's communication is complete, that disclosure requirement would come into play. Just take a look at that. And I was taken by Roger's comment that if the auditor is doing the communicating because management hasn't, for whatever the reason might be, seems to me that ought to be brought to the attention of the audit committee specifically. I'm talking to you about this because I'm required to do so because somebody else didn't. And leading to the question of, well, why didn't somebody else? And whether it's a lack of competence, an unwillingness, whatever it might be, that's a really important piece of information for an audit committee to have. So as you focus on this redrafting, as Marty referred to it, and I agree with it, about different responsibilities, if the auditor responsibility comes into play because management has not carried out their responsibilities, there are implications to that that need to be communicated. I thought it was a very good point.
Thanks, Mike, for that comment. And one other point I'd just like to mention, a question was raised earlier during this discussion as to what critical and significant to whom, to the investor, to the auditor, whatever. And I think the answer was, in my view, was given by Professor Cox that I agreed with, and that was these matters are significant or critical to an understanding of the fair presentation of the financial statements. And so they are critical to an understanding of the fair presentation of financial statements by the auditor, by whomever. So I think that's the context in which I understand those words, and I just thought I'd share that. I think that was the comment made by Professor Cox that I wanted to join in with that interpretation of significant and critical.
Might be worthwhile to add those words.
With that, I think we're ready to take a break, and we were scheduled to break at 12 and get back at 1, but we're a little late on that, but let's still try to get back at 1. Thank you.